Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
The Killer Bees!
Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios. ESPN 97.5 and 92.5 proudly present The Killer Bees.
Definitely a fan of The Killer Bees.
Now bringing you the fastest 3 hours in Houston sports radio. Here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
What up, Baytown? Hey, how we doing?
Hey, it's Joel. I'm Jeremy. It is a Wednesday edition of The Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5. We're battling the elements today a little bit inside the studio. That's all right. The Astros getting the victory yesterday. The magic number down to 1. I was like Dusty Baker. I wasn't staying up for that West Coast game to see if the Astros clinched yesterday, which they didn't. The Mariners got the victory over Oakland. But hey, the Astros, they had lost 3 in a row in Oakland. They had lost 4 in a row overall. You're starting to at least let the thought enter a little bit in the back of your mind.
You were.
I think a lot of the city was, too, a little bit, especially when the Astros trailed 2-0 after the first inning in that game, whenever Phil Maton, pitching in the 9th inning, gives up a home run to allow the Rays to take the lead. But the Astros, in come-from-behind fashion, get the victory. And now I think everybody in Houston, even though it's not clinched, breathing a little bit easier about the Houston Astros.
Yeah, I think they are, and I think that we would be having a whole totally different conversation if we were having that based upon another loss where they were shut down by a guy that in Michael Wacha that you never should have been shut down by, and you were no hit for 5 innings. And then after you completely changed the momentum and the guy that we talked about a few weeks ago when I said was a guy that I had no problem having confidence in stepping up in the biggest moments and down the stretch, and Jose Altuve did it again, hit the home run, tied the game, and for about 3.5 minutes you had all the room in the world to celebrate and be absolutely vocal about your Houston Astros. And then lo and behold, Dusty's gonna Dusty. And Dusty went with the crusty guy that has been absolutely hot garbage lately in Phil Maton. And Mr. Maton came in and did exactly what we all feared. And before you knew it, you were looking at basically another stressful situation with a game that got away, with now time ticking on what you need to do and a lot more worry setting in. But then, lo and behold, the Astros did what they need to do now from now through the end of the season. That is step up in clutch moments. Do the kind of things that good teams to great teams do. Get those great at-bats like you got from Jason Castro. But before him, Chaz McCormick was monstrous in the way he was able to stay alive, fouling pitch after pitch off until he got his walk. Everybody stepped up and did their job. That's the kind of thing you like to see from an Astros team, to give you some confidence, to give you some momentum, to give you the feeling and the belief that this team is capable when all the high leverage in the world is sitting on your shoulders of coming through.
What'd you think of Jose Urquidy getting the start yesterday? It looks like he's going to be in the playoff rotation. We were already on that side of it, too. But then pregame yesterday, Dusty Baker saying that Zach Greinke came to him and wants to pitch out of the bullpen in the postseason. Greinke will get a rehab start tomorrow for Sugarland. But it seems like Greinke will be in the pen. So Jose Urquidy is a guy you're going to count on to start in the postseason. 2 runs, 4 hits, 5 innings. He struck out 6 through 91 pitches. It was kind of weird Urquidy game in that he threw a lot of pitches early, which he normally doesn't do.
Yeah, you know what? But again, the blemishes came in the first inning on 2 legitimate hits. After that, you had Kiermaier with a ball that I think could have been caught by Tucker in right field. But regardless, it wasn't good, solid contact. If you wanted to look at the exit velocity, I'm sure it was basically timed at less than what it takes for a catcher to throw it back to the pitcher, let alone a ball that came off the barrel hard. And then the squib hit by Lowe that actually was foul, came back fair, and found its way, a seeing eye grounder around third base. Those weren't hits that bothered me. Once he settled in, and these things are going to happen for starting pitchers. You're not always going to have your best stuff or get off to the best start. What I liked was, even down 2-0, he bounced back. He was grinding. He was making sure that he was making his pitches. He pounds the zone, which is so important for a team so that the defense doesn't sit on their heels and get caught watching long, boring at-bats and walks. And so for that reason alone, I thought that I give him the benefit of the doubt and say, look, he did what he needed to do. And two runs is still a quality start. He didn't go long enough, obviously, to get one of those. But what he did do was keep you in the game, not lose the game for you, by actually kind of getting your dauber down after giving up the two and just basically giving up hope. He continued to battle.
Yeah, he did. I thought the home run he gave up, too, wasn't a bad pitch. I mean, it was a breaking ball out of the zone low, and Yandy Diaz disposed of it into the Crawford box. This might not have been a home run everywhere in Major League Baseball. So I thought he pitched all right. I think it shows you more of who Tampa Bay is as an offense, too, that they are able to battle these long at-bats, chase starters early in games. That's a good offense that, you know, maybe doesn't have, you know, that stud. But 1 through 9, they make pitchers work, and that was a good example of that yesterday. I mean, watching that game yesterday, I didn't get any sense of urgency from Dusty Baker, right? Like, he was managing that game like it was a dog day of the summer game. I thought not pinch hitting for Martin Maldonado to lead off the eighth inning was a mistake. He ended up going to Castro for Maldonado for the game-winning walk-off walk, but Castro would have been in that spot anyways if he pinch hit in the eighth inning because he would have stayed in the game to catch. And then Maton in the ninth inning. What is Phil Maton doing in the ninth inning of a tie game in late September? That was mind-boggling to me.
You hold your breath as it was when he came into the game because you know that he's capable of putting kerosene on a fire. And instead, he found his way and matriculated his way barely out of an inning so that you go, okay, whew, exhale, we're okay. We're still going to be in a one-run game or in what turns out to be a tie game. You're like, you know what? Dodged a bullet there. Didn't give up like two or three runs to the Rays, give them a pad to which they could have just closed the door. And now you're in a true ball game again where, you know, every pitch is important. There's the last thing you think you're going to see is Maton go back out on the hill. And I understand that, you know, Graveman's out on paternity leave. That's fine. You still have guys in that bullpen, not named Ryan Pressly, that I trust a whole lot more than Maton, and guys that can get guys out. The fact that Dusty played a whim again, and it looked like it was going to bite him in the butt. And he's so lucky it didn't, because otherwise he would have to start eventually facing scrutiny for these kind of Dusty Baker moves. But somehow, some way, they gave him some more escapability by getting out of this one and getting a win. We're having a whole different conversation, and this topic alone could take a segment or two, because the Dusty-isms are starting to stack up as negatives more and more and more. And you just really want to know, what were you thinking there?
Well, let's ask Dusty Baker what he was thinking with Maton pitching the ninth.
They had all those left-hand hitters up, and, you know, he was the best choice that we had, you know, against their left-hand hitters. And invariably, the right-hander, Arizarena, is the one that got him. And, you know, he made quality pitches all night except that one pitch to Arena. Rosarena was a hanging slider. And, boy, you know, they're not missing these pitches. I've never seen anything like it. They don't pop them up. They don't hit them in the ground. They, you know, hit them over the fence. So, boy, we needed that one, you know, so badly.
So Dusty with the idea of pitching Maton because they had a couple of lefties in the lineup that were due up in the ninth as opposed to the one righty in Arozarena who hit the home run against Maton. So you can understand the logic, I guess, that they like Maton more against lefties than, let's say, like a Ryan Stanek. Like Kendall Graveman on the paternity list, he was not there. Ryan Pressly, we found out later as well, was not available. He has a sore knee, although Dusty says that he could pitch as soon as today. So how hurt was he yesterday? Questionable decision there, no doubt, for the Houston Astro manager. They got bailed out in the ninth inning. Yordan Alvarez, and look, they were pretty lucky to get bailed out too, right? Yordan Alvarez gets the seeing eye single, the infield single to the right side. Carlos Correa hits a rocket up the middle where Franco almost made an unbelievable play to get Correa out at first base. He was called out originally. I thought that the review was actually going to uphold the call. I didn't think that there was enough evidence to call Correa out, but the Astros got the break there too.
The key was if they were relying on, and what I was concerned about was in the review center, if they were going to focus just on ball in back of glove, foot on bag, that you're absolutely right. But when they finally got the down the right field angle to show the foot removed from the bag when the catch was made, that was the difference maker to me. It was just, would they concentrate on that? Would they have that angle? Or were they solely focused as an umpire normally is, especially in the angle that he's at in watching the bang-bang play, glove in ball when the contact is made as opposed to foot on bag? Luckily, they got the right angle. They got the call right. And the Astros were able to take advantage, because otherwise that could have been devastating all in itself.
See, I still didn't think it was totally conclusive. I thought they might get you in the it's not totally conclusive put spike on the bag, especially like he had a white shoe on with a white bag, you know.
Well, but you can't see the silver spike either, so yeah. You wonder if the spike isn't attached somewhere to that bag, because that would cause that gap.
Yeah, gun to my head, I think he was off the bag. I wasn't sure that it was 100% obvious that he was off the bag, but you know when what, you Brandon, zoom in like that.
I mean, Jeremy, it's freaking trash can banging G-Man Choi. The guy that thought he would have a little extra party and stick it to the Astros in the dugout, banging his little mini garbage can when they were going to put the Astros away. Screw him. That's how I feel about it. Take that to the bank, big boy. You didn't get that one.
So that put runners at first and second. Kyle Tucker, what eventually kind of amounted to a sacrifice bunt, right? He hits the ball to the right side. You move the runners to second and third. They intentionally walked Diaz, which backfired, right? Because you don't walk Diaz there. You pitch to him. You get some wiggle room. But once you put him on, once you load the bases, now you can't walk a guy. Chaz McCormick had an unbelievable plate appearance that went to, 10-11 pitches. And then Jason Castro with another great plate appearance, and the Astros with a walk-off walk. And Dusty Baker, after the game, excited about the victory.
Well, those are hell of at-bats by McCormick. I mean, he battled them, and it took some quality pitches, and the same for Castro. You know, Castro took the ball inside, you know, that the pitcher thought was a strike, and then it worked into 3-2, and, you know, we certainly didn't need to go, you know, into extra innings. We wanted to win that right there.
And the Astros did win it right there. Later in the night, Mariners get the victory over Oakland. So the magic number is still one. Something, you know, I didn't hate that Seattle won that game yesterday, because I want the Astros to clinch it themselves. I want the Astros to win it today, hopefully, and celebrate on the field, celebrate the AL West, let the fans get in on the party as well. So I wasn't too mad that Seattle beat Oakland yesterday, because I do want the Astros to get the victory and celebrate it on their own merit.
I was because of the fact that I want it in their rearview mirror as quick as possible, because I don't trust the day-to-day lineups of Dusty Baker. We just got done again getting into a lot of his decision-making. And though I like Dusty as a person and I'm pulling for Dusty as a manager, there are times that I just left scratching my temple going, what the hell is he doing? And I don't like the fact that it's one thing when you've got a 6-7-8 game lead and you're coasting and you're winning series after series and you're doing it in the last game of a series after you've already wrapped it up, that you do these kind of things. But it's totally different when you are in the middle of a dogfight to still wrap up the division. You still got to hang on to stay ahead of the White Sox for home field in the first round. And there's so many bigger fish to fry going through after that, the series after series that takes you as far as you want to go as a ball club. I don't like to be screwing around with these kind of things. I want to put them in the rearview mirror as quick as possible. Like you said, I hope it happens tonight. I hope it happens with Michael Brantley in the lineup, because he wasn't last night, and that's a massive key. And those are the kind of things that I'm checking off my checklist as I get ready for the playoffs.
Yeah, it seems like Brantley could be back as soon as today, although Dusty Baker yesterday in the little media session he has before the games, the scrum in the dugout, said he doesn't know if Brantley's going to be able to play outfield. So we could be looking at a possibility where Michael Brantley's your full-time DH in the postseason, which means you're going to have to put out what is perhaps your suboptimal defense, right, with Yordan Alvarez in left field. And it also brings up the question again, Brantley against lefties. So you're still going to DH him against lefties, since he's not going to be out on the field, whenever you can have a better defensive outfield there now as well if you put Chaz and Jake Myers in the outfield. Those are conversations for another day. Meanwhile, the wild card race, well, it's getting tight. Yankees beating the Blue Jays yesterday, so the Yankees in a pretty good position now, and they might even get to a position where, look, they still have to win a couple games here this week, but they might put themselves in a position where they can hold Gerrit Cole out for game 163 in the wild card round. Meanwhile, that second spot, Boston, a half game up on Seattle. The Seattle Mariners are a half game out of the playoffs because they've won 9 of their last 10 and 3 straight. Meanwhile, the Blue Jays are just one game back. So that race for the second wild card, Joel, it is heating up, and it's going to be something to watch here over the final week.
Again, this is why baseball did what it did to create the second wild card, because they want to make the last week of the season hyper interesting, regardless of the divisions are wrapped up or not. They're getting exactly what they wanted. I thought Blummer was out of his mind a little bit when he was mentioning how it would be great if there was a 3-team playoff for the wild card. And he threw Seattle into there and was talking about the travel and everything else. I think even Todd Callis was like, wait a minute, what? I thought we were talking about Red Sox, Blue Jays, Yankees. But lo and behold, here come the Mariners. And, you know, credit to Scott Servais, a guy I grew up playing against from Wisconsin, that has done a magnificent job of taking a team that was supposed to be in a full rebuild and bringing them along to where now they are a force to be reckoned with as one of the good young teams in this league. If they somehow, some way get in, they already have won this season for the franchise, because that's a massive, massive positive. But the fact that they continue to keep playing good baseball, they came from behind last night. They were down 1-0. And like you, I was ready to go to bed. Before I went to bed, I checked the score one more time. They were suddenly up 2-1. They didn't look back. They won 4-2. You got to give them credit, because every time you think you write them off for dead, they're still hanging around. From the Blue Jays' perspective, a team that has all that good young talent, that has gone out and spent all that money for good, solid, quality starting pitching, just can't seem to get it all to click right at the exact same time. Therefore, the Yankees, with that win, put them squarely behind the eight ball and trying to play catch up to try and get in.
Mariners are either really lucky or they're really good in close games. Mariners a minus 50 run differential, the only team that's even close to being in playoff contention with a negative run differential. And then if you look at their expected win-loss record, their expected win-loss is 74-84. Like, they have no business being in this conversation, but credit to Scott Servais doing a good job with a team that hasn't been expected to win many games. They're winning the close ones. And here they are with just a few days left in the regular season, just a half game out of the playoffs in the American League. 713-780-3776 if you want to get in. What did you make of some of the Dusty's decisions in yesterday's game yesterday? What do you make of these Major League Baseball playoff races? 713-780-ESPN. You can find us at Twitch, twitch.tv/ESPN975. He's at Pac-Man Joel, and I'm at Jeremy Branham. Coming up next, new revelations about Bill O'Brien's tenure in Houston. That might shock you? That might make you angry? That's next. Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
Before we go to the break, we'll tell you about the good people at Apollo Men's Health. Look, I was texting back and forth with Dr. O yesterday. Look, if you want someone that truly cares, that knows what he's doing, that's an expert in his field, that's been there at those other places and knows what works and what doesn't and doesn't want to waste your time, when you're looking for energy, you go to Apollo Men's Health. Two locations near downtown Houston to better serve you. But the fact of the matter is, if you're a man or a woman and you're looking for that kind of get up and go, that got up and went, and you want to get it back again, you thought you couldn't, no, you can. You just go to Apollo. Because if you see the people at Apollo Men's Health, they have hormone therapy for both men and women. You can do it weekly by coming in the office. You can administer it yourself at home, and they'll tell you how. If you're a guy and you want cutting-edge pellet testosterone therapy, you can get it done where you only got to come into the office once every 6 months, but you still reap all the benefits, get all the energy, and feel so much better about yourself on a daily basis. They have that and so much more. You want to get on a workout program? They have a complete body composition analysis that only takes a minute but can give you results you can chart as you continue to go down that journey. If you want to recover quicker, HGH peptide therapy. So many different things they can help you with, and it starts by making the first appointment. Go to ApolloMH.com, and you're going to find out most major insurance has accepted discounts for military personnel and first responders. You mention my name, Joel Blank, get a free B12 shot on your first visit. Then let the process go from there. They're going to ask tough questions. You give them honest answers, they're going to get your results. They're good people doing great things. It's the good people at Apollo Men's Health.
ESPN 97.5. Now back to the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
All right, new revelations about Bill O'Brien's tenure in Houston. This comes from a book, It's Better to Be Feared, by Seth Wickersham, who writes for ESPN. The book's about Kraft, Brady, Belichick, and the dynamic that they had during the dynasty that were the New England Patriots. And, of course, the news is coming out this week because guess who plays Sunday Night Football? It's Tom Brady and the Buccaneers invading New England to take on Bill Belichick and his Patriots. But it does have some parts of this book about Bill O'Brien. And ultimately, according to the book, Kraft, Brady, and a few others discuss scenarios about who would eventually replace Belichick if he retired before Brady was done. If offensive coordinator Josh McDaniels left after the season, remember, he was flirting with the Colts. In fact, he took the Colts' job and then turned it down, went back to being the OC of New England. There was some thought out there that New England could hire O'Brien and he could perhaps one day succeed Belichick. Like, just looking at that paragraph alone, like, it's kind of bizarre that there was ever a day in which New England Patriot fans wanted Bill O'Brien to be the heir apparent to perhaps the greatest football coach in NFL history in Bill Belichick.
Look, Bill O'Brien's a D-bag, and it's the short nasty, but it has to be said. I mean, look, this team and this city and this fan base continued to try and support Bill O'Brien and a lot of the things that he was doing. especially early on when he wasn't doing them well, especially with all the faux pas with time management and timeouts and when to throw the red flag, and then the massive ego that wouldn't let him as a control freak let anybody else in. And when he did, the minute that you went against him, like Brian Gain, you were shown the door. And that was all still somewhat forgiven until he did the unthinkable and traded the best receiver in football for peanuts. And at that point, you knew that the writing was on the wall and this guy wasn't a good dude. And he was selfish and he was all about himself. Because at the end of the day, before he was fired, I started talking about this, saying, look, Bill O'Brien's only in this thing for Bill O'Brien. He doesn't care what kind of assets and resources and draft picks this franchise has 3, 4, 5 years down the road. He'll give them all away if it means it can save his ass and save his job for a couple more years here in Houston so he can be the head coach, GM, and steal money. And lo and behold, he tried to do just that. He left a Grand Canyon-sized hole in his wake when he left town. And now he's going to get another job because he hooked on with the greatest college football coach in the game. And just doing what he's doing for Nick Saban will be good enough to get him another head coaching job, though he doesn't deserve it. So Bill O'Brien, if this book is even remotely true, and we always say when things like this come out, even in as it all comes out in the tea leaves, the truth is probably somewhere in the middle. Even on the short end of him considering that to the very high end of him actually going forth, and that was his philosophy and that he was trying to do, he is a D-bag. He is an a-hole. He screwed this franchise, this town, and this city, and whatever comes out of this book that he's going to try and deny, I hope it gives him the worst reputation on the planet, and I really do hope it sets him back in trying to get another head coaching job.
There's everything that you said I agree with for the most part. And look, Bill O'Brien lies through his teeth all the time, and I think he's been called on that. You remember Case Keenum whenever he wrote the book about when he got cut by Bill O'Brien, and like I forget the exact story, but he told Case Keenum that he could never be a quarterback in this league, and then all of a sudden he was starting against the Texans with Minnesota against Houston when Minnesota was really good. And I asked Bill O'Brien in his press conference if he'd heard the remarks from Case Keenum in his book, and he said that he didn't. And I'm sorry, but I'm going to believe Case Keenum over Bill O'Brien. I understand I'm wearing a U of H shirt today, but I'm believing Case Keenum over Bill O'Brien. A couple of things that you said there. Look, Bill O'Brien, terrible general manager, perhaps the worst general manager in history. But to me, this is more about why you do not allow your head coach to be your general manager than it was Bill O'Brien trying to preserve his job. Because what NFL head coach wouldn't do what Bill O'Brien did? Now, he might not make as stupid of trades, but you're going to be looking to preserve your own job. You're not going to care about years 5 through 10 in the organization. You're going to look at years 1 through 5. So I actually put blame on Bill O'Brien being the general manager on this team with Cal McNair and perhaps even Jack Easterby, whoever was making those decisions. Because once you put a head coach in the position to be the general manager, he's not looking for the future. So I don't really blame Bill O'Brien for doing that. The second part about it, like he now is the OC for Nick Saban. Like the fact that Nick Saban brought him in as the offensive coordinator, does that tell you that Bill O'Brien's a pretty good offensive mind?
I don't think so. I think that what it tells you is that Nick Saban, one, he's a Belichick guy. They're friends. And two, he likes a guy that has the NFL, that brings a little weight with him to the program. Look, you know what? Whether it's Sarkisian, whether it's Lane Kiffin, the guys that he brought in had a name. And whether the reputation was good or bad, they had one. And a lot of people knew who they were. So it was another guy on the ball club that the offense had to respect and listen to and believe could do great things for them. And I think that's what he did with Bill O'Brien. He worked with the greatest quarterback of all time in Tom Brady. He worked with the greatest coach of all time in Bill Belichick. That in itself on a resume says to every kid playing for Alabama, here's a guy I got to respect and listen to because he's been there and done that, and I need him to do it for me too. So I think that's why Nick Saban did what he did and his relationship with Belichick. I don't think, other than that, that you can deny the fact that there are other and there still are better candidates to be offensive minds and offensive coaches for Alabama or anywhere else, but you got to have an in to get in, and that would be a connection to Saban. O'Brien had it. It worked out for him. I don't even want to say good for him because I don't want all those good things football-wise to happen to him because of what he did here.
Here was the damning thing in the book, It's Better to Be Feared by Seth Wickersham, as far as it goes with Bill O'Brien. O'Brien was in a power struggle of his own in Houston, fighting with GM Rick Smith, a dysfunctional and toxic situation, the Chronicle called it. The leaks from O'Brien's camp claiming he wanted out were so aggressive as to be suspicious, as if he knew he had a golden parachute. In the end, though, the Texans chose O'Brien over Smith, giving the coach more control over football operations. O'Brien later joked to a confidant that it was a somewhat empty victory. I was trying to get fired, he said. And look, O'Brien was flirting with other teams in the NFL around this time, and I didn't like O'Brien at the time. I said, get rid of him, bring in Shanahan, let him be your head coach going forward. I don't really look at this as damning on Bill O'Brien as much as I look at this as damning to the organization. Like the fact that you have a guy, Bill O'Brien, who, look, he had won some division titles, 9-7, Brian, 9-7, Brian, AFC South champions, Brian. And you had Rick Smith. Like, at the time, you're probably going to lean Bill O'Brien there because I think that there was more frustration with Rick Smith, the general manager. But I blame this on the Texans front office. I blame this on the decision makers of the Houston Texans. The fact that you give the head coach, general manager power, it, to me, is a damning thing for the Houston Texans front office and for the Houston Texans organization. And we've seen it all play out. We've seen the Texans go from being a playoff team, a team with Deshaun Watson, where it looks like you have a promising future, superstars with DeAndre Hopkins and J.J. Watt. And what do you have left to show for it now? And I think it all started with the decision right there where the Texans organization said, Bill O'Brien, you're the captain of our ship. You are to lead us. And look, Bill O'Brien was terrible at the job, but they're the ones that gave O'Brien the power.
Well, they did, but you forget, Jeremy, that somewhere in the mix there, before they did that, they gave him at least the say-so in helping to get the guy that he would work with on a daily basis in Brian Gain. And Brian Gain came out of that Patriots mold, came out of being handpicked by Bill O'Brien. So Bill O'Brien basically told that management staff and team and ownership group that, hey, I trust this guy. This is the guy I want. This is the guy I believe that can get us where we need to go. And the minute that Brian Gain disagreed with Bill O'Brien, he made his life hell. He stabbed him in the back, and he showed him the door. And then he took over. And then he became the absolute power-hungry egomaniac that got both gigs, though he had no experience at doing one and very little on the NFL level of doing the other. And that is the thing that is a travesty from the organizational standpoint. But the actual moves that were made, the actual day-to-day operations, is all on his shoulders. And that's why I blame him wholeheartedly for all of this, just like I blame him for being the guy that brought in his own guy only to show him the door way too quickly. Because what Brian Gain has proven is he's a very solid NFL football mind in the front office of any football team, currently with the Buffalo Bills doing great things. And what they've done personnel-wise has put together one hell of a roster. I think that what you see is a disconnect between the ownership group led by Cal McNair and Bill O'Brien. Once Robert McNair passed away and Cal was given the reins, he absolutely didn't know what to do with them. He actually tried to tie a shoe with them. He basically tried to try a slip knot with them, but he had no clue in what it meant to have those reins in his hand and be the decision maker, not Bill O'Brien, thus letting a guy like Bill O'Brien trade away your best asset, your best player in DeAndre Hopkins, and torch a relationship with maybe the best player in franchise history in terms of reputation on and off the field in J.J. Watt.
Cal McNair did all of that stuff, sure. Remember, Bob McNair was the one that was in this dinner conversation with Rick Smith and Bill O'Brien and ultimately made that decision. But maybe the apple doesn't fall too far away from the tree. One other thing to keep in mind, like, Rick Smith had some victories as the GM for the Texans, some really good victories. He's the one who drafted J.J. Watt, right? He's the one who signed Arian Foster as an undrafted free agent. Who was the guy who traded up to draft Deshaun Watson? That was Rick Smith.
But he was also the guy that signed the quarterback that blew up on him in Brock Osweiler that
was
led
that,
you to have
was
to
that Rick Smith or was it Bill O'Brien saying, go get me that guy?
It's a good question. It was one of it was either both or one or the other.
Which one do you want as your GM, Rick Smith or Bill O'Brien?
Rick Smith.
No doubt about it.
Simply just from an experience standpoint, because look, Jeremy, I'm not going to say that I'm the biggest Rick Smith fan in the world either, because you can say what you want. He got his first round picks right, but those, are, and when you ask a lot of people, are the easiest ones to make because there's been so much tape looked at and so many different evaluations done where it's harder to miss on a first rounder. When you start looking at his track record in the third, fourth, fifth, sixth rounds, in the middle to later rounds of the drafts, even second rounds to some degree, that's where he swung and missed a whole lot and had guys that not only weren't starters, didn't stick around on the rosters of not only the Texans but other teams. So I can poke a lot of holes at Rick Smith, but you're right. Rick Smith was invited to the dinner table at Thanksgiving and Christmas every single year with the McNairs, and all of a sudden, because of Bill O'Brien, he was shown the door, and that's not something that normally the McNairs would be likely to do without the influence of Bill O'Brien.
I want to be clear. Neither one would be the GM for my team, but if I'm forced to pick one or the other, Rick Smith is the guy being the general manager, not Bill O'Brien. O'Brien better coach than Rick Smith, but Rick Smith the better GM. Houston, what do you make of this article from Seth Wickersham? Who do you think dropped the ball on this organization that has the Texans where they are now? 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. We'll get to your calls when we return. Also, 3-0 teams in the NFL that you aren't buying, 0-3 teams that you think still have a shot. That's next. Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5.
Hey, before we go to the break, I want to tell you, if you were looking to put some money down on any games, NFL, college, maybe some Major League Baseball getting close for the playoffs, want to back your Astros tonight, You can go to mybookie.ag. The reason why I say go to mybookie.ag is simple, because one, your money's safe and secure. When you put it in, it's not going out unless you take it out. And when you bet with mybookie.ag and you put in the promo code BET975, it's going to be beneficial because they're going to double your first deposit up to $1,000. If you're an existing client, you say, well, why not me? Oh, it's you too. Up to $1,000. Use the code BET975. If you used to be with mybookie.ag, haven't bet in a while, get back in, use that promo code, and reap the benefits of double your first deposit up to $1,000. You've got Thursday night football coming up on the horizon. You've got another big weekend of college and pro football to bet on. Like I said, baseball, soccer, you name it, they got it, including live in-game betting. It's all part of the process. You can bet on your laptop. You can bet on your cell phone. You can bet on your iPad. All different ways that you can bet. And when you bet and win, they're going to pay you as well. They're not going to hem and haw and try and hang on to your deposit and your money and tell you to reinvest it. They're going to pay you out if you want your cash after you get a victory. They also have lots of promos going on that cost you nothing to get involved. But when you win, you get paid because that's the way they take care of their customers. Check them out today, mybookie.ag. Sign up, put in the promo code BET975, start reaping the benefits. More money in your account, more games to play, more chances to win. Bet anything, anytime, anywhere with MyBookie.
ESPN 97.5.
I assumed you knew.
Now back to the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
All right, let's go out to the HRP listener line, 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. We'll start with Joe. Joe, you're in the hive with the Killer Bees.
Yeah, man. All I think is that when Bill O'Brien had a power struggle with Rick Smith, that happens from time to time. You know, I mean, it happens, and he won that struggle, and that's one thing. But when he turns around and has the exact same struggle with the next guy, you know what they say: if you run into a jerk, you run into a jerk. If you're running into jerks all day long, you're the jerk. And by the time that he gets around to he wants to get rid of the second GM in a row, that should have been the red flag. So you got to put that on the front office. But everything that he did from the moment he took over was downhill for the Texans, from poor trades to you name it. I mean, everything he did there towards the end just wrecked us completely. But the decision to put him there is squarely on the shoulders. They should have kept Brian Gain and found their new coach then.
Yeah, I'm with you, Joe. I think you can make two bad decisions, right? The first bad decision was empowering Bill O'Brien with the status as the general manager, and then Bill O'Brien made a series of bad decisions to put the organization where it's at here. So I think they were both abstract failures on both fronts. All right, let's go back out to the HR&P listener line, 713-780-3776. Let's go to Mario. Mario, you're in the hive with the Killer Bees.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. Wanted to talk about, first off, Dusty's decisions and in-game decisions are terrible, and if our offense has bailed him out, I'm scared to see what our record would be or what it is for all the one-run games we've had where the offense wasn't able to bail him out. But I was calling mainly about Castro. I think Castro should start most of the games, and then we use Maldi, who I love and who I get why we play him, but I think he should be the defensive replacement that comes in the fifth or sixth inning, or excuse me, the seventh inning, to close out the game. I just think that not that Castro's is a great hitter, but he is a better hitter than Maldi. And thank you for bringing it up about Choi, because I can't stand the guy, and I really wish we would he would find a four seamer up around the leg area to just remind them that we heard it too.
Yeah.
So thank you guys for the show.
Thanks, Mario. Appreciate the call. Look, here's the thing. You can't – I understand what you're saying, because lately and in clutch situations this year, Castro the Astros been good. But overall, Castro's not been good.
He's been better than Maldonado offensively.
Offensively fine, but not defensively, because here's the key. Maldi not only has a cannon, which Castro doesn't have, he calls a fantastic game, which the Astros need. He's bilingual, which helps immensely in the short-term time that you have in meetings at the mound, and when he and Correa are getting up in somebody's ass trying to get one of these young pitchers to refocus and realize what has to be done, which you're not going to get out of a Jason Castro. You're not going to get that same fire and passion either, the way Maldi plays the game. That's why I appreciate the call, but it's also the luxury that you have with the Astros, because offensively you don't need the better bat in Castro. You need the guy that manages the pitching staff, because 1 through 8, you're too good to have to make a decision based on the bat, not the glove and the ability to call a game.
Couldn't agree with you more. Maldonado's the starter for me because of how he handles the pitching staff, how he, you know, he's just a good catcher, good defensive catcher with a good arm. Maldonado's the guy that should start. And the offense is good enough to pick up the slack for Maldonado. Castro, in the role that he used yesterday, he's a pinch hitter, I think is the way to go there. As far as Dusty Baker in close games, look, the record for the Astros in close games hasn't been good. How much does that fall on the manager? I say a decent amount. All right, we're going to take an early break here. Jonathan Fagan covers the Rockets for the Chronicle. Join us next. The Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5.
Well, hello.
To call into the HRNP listener line, dial 713-780-ESPN.
Dial the phone.
Disappointed by your HR and payroll technology? Maybe you need to outsource your administration. Go to HRP.net to learn more. Now back to the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
All right, joining us now on the HRMP guest line is Jonathan Fagan, covers the Rockets for the Houston Chronicle. He's out in Galveston covering training camp now. So, Jonathan, if you need a run to make it out to practice, just let us know and we'll end the conversation there. The thing I was reading yesterday from your story was the fact of how Kevin Porter Jr. said the Rockets saved his life potentially. We talked about it on the show yesterday, if it was maybe more dramatic than it seemed. What do you think of it all?
Well, that was some quote, wasn't it?
It was.
Well, you know, I can't say it's more dramatic because that's pretty big time feeling. That if he feels that way, whether they actually did or not, doesn't really matter. He feels that way. And that's big, that it means so much to him that an organization believes in him, you know, and they really do. It's not just words and it's not media day talk. John Wall is a five-time All-Star who's going to watch Kevin Porter Jr. play this year. So this organization absolutely is believing in Kevin Porter Jr. They've spent a lot of time with him. You know, Rafael Stone has spent a lot of time with him. They come from a similar area, not very far apart in the Seattle area. And they've talked a lot about that and their backgrounds together and, you know, both coming from, you know, both being point guards, actually. Back in the day when Rafael played, he was a point guard, you know, from Point Guard City. And so they've gotten to know one another beyond just, you know, go out and hoop. Obviously, John Lucas and Stephen Silas, that's who they are. That's what they do. So this guy feels really embraced. While what happened in Cleveland, that was the culmination of just really feeling isolated. You know, when he blew up in the end, and that's what was sort of the last straw, it wasn't just because his locker got moved. It was a feeling that increased throughout his relatively brief time there. So he needed a fresh start. They gave it to him. The Rockets got him for nothing. And now, I mean, and they moved his position to the point, and, you know, he's a big part of their future and knows it, and it means that much to him. I think without basketball, he was feeling lost, and that's what he was saying, that, you know, what am I, what have I got? Basketball was escape for me, and then I didn't have the escape.
Jonathan,
and now he's got it back.
Joel Blank here. I'm new to this, following this team, but I'm interested in your opinions now. In the way
you're new to following the state?
Yes, absolutely. As an outsider looking in, I'm curious your opinion on the press conference with Rafael Stone and John Wall, because I know that it's a new day and age and how you handle players with kid gloves and their agents, and you have a reputation so that other players are going to want to play here. But look, when have you ever in your career seen a general manager that's come out and said, look, John did all the right things last year we asked him to do, so we really want to do what's right for John Wall and, you know, and do what's necessary until we can find him a home. You're doing everything you need to do by paying him $45 million a year. And the fact that you now have a young nucleus, I mean, you tell me, you followed him every single day all last season. John Wall, when he was in games, he looked off Christian Wood. He was making sure he got his a lot of times. He basically said from the time Harden left town, this was my team. And it seemed like that kind of translated on the floor from time to time. He's a tough guy to trade also, regardless. But when I look at it, I just thought it was surprising from an organization to go that far to say, hey, with everything that John Wall did for us last year, you know, we want him around, we want him to hang around, he's not going to play, but we're going to do what's right by John Wall.
Well, a lot of parts to that. You know, as far as his play last year, the way you worded it was time to time, and that's what I would agree. That, yeah, there were times he blew up where he was trying to harness all that, you know, John Wall athleticism and dominate.
Yep.
And, okay, we're in the middle of a 20-game losing streak. There's 5 minutes left. I'm taking over. Then there were other times he was terrific, you know, where he didn't do that. Where he had just the right amount of control of it all. And so time to time was a good way to put it. And I think that's the way it is the first year back after missing almost two full seasons. Now he's got his athleticism back, but you still have to have it your control. And I don't mean under control, like slow down. I mean, where you're sort of in charge of everything, mm-hmm. where you're not going too far. How do you dominate without, you know, getting out of control and take, you know, blowing up, which he did. But, you know, the thing that they really liked last year was, you know, this is a losing team. They're on their way to a 17-win season. They're playing guys who won't be in the NBA after that season. And he was, and then even when he went out for the rest of the year, he was dialed in. He was the guy during timeouts who was totally involved. He wasn't, you know, I'm the veteran. I've spent 10 years. I make $47 million. You know, good luck to you guys. He was working to help people. And that was good. They really appreciated that. All that said, he's not playing because they want Kevin Porter Jr. and Jalen Green to play 32 minutes a night.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they want those guys to begin growing. They don't want to wait the 3-4 months it might take to trade John Wall before they get starters minutes. He understood that. And he's not fighting them on that. And so maybe it's good for them, for him too, but it's also an organizational decision. What's good for them basketball-wise? I think they do appreciate, though, that he, yeah, I get it, go for it. You know, he's all right with that. The fact that he was on board, the fact that he did media day,
yeah.
Most guys in his situations wouldn't. He sort of made, there's no controversy here over that. You know, that somebody asked me yesterday, who would you rather be right now, Daryl Morey or Rafael Stone? And, you know, come on, Daryl has a chance to win a championship this year.
Yeah.
But still, Daryl Morey probably doesn't sleep as well at night right now either.
But Daryl's also getting monster checks from both teams, if you believe what you've heard.
But if you believe what I've written, so yeah,
yeah.
I believe it.
I mean, you have heard as well as I have. My question then becomes, is he tradable, and John Wall? And then is there truth to what we've heard in that he isn't interested in a buyout, which really – essentially says either you can find a multiple team trade where someone's willing to take all that on, or as much as he's been a good soldier, he may not go anywhere.
Well, that's a great question. I think there's a chance close to the deadline, because by then the Rockets will have paid, you know, $25 million or so of this year's salary. And so a team can treat him almost as an expiring contract with next year's. Now, it's $47 million next year,
mm-hmm.
but you're trading back 33 or so, 35 or so. And so your added expense isn't that gigantic. He can help a team, a really good team. You know, and if you're competing for a championship, and that's the difference of whether you get there or not, a Derrick Rose type of role.
Mm-hmm.
Where, okay, Derrick Rose was an MVP at the time. Well, you're not in the MVP role anymore, but you're the difference. We're counting on you in playoff games. John Wall can be that. And then if teams get an injury at point guard, you know, or even in the backcourt, and they can play John Wall with whoever their point guard is, in that time of year, then there's a chance. The Rockets would take back a guy they don't think much, a whole lot of, if it brings them an asset they do. You know, in other words, so you have two guys and they make a total of 35, 37 million. Well, if one of them is, hey,
you know, we like getting this guy here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then you do it and you eat the money on the other.
Jonathan Fagan covers the Rockets for the Chronicle out in Galveston with the Rockets training camp. What are a couple of the biggest storylines that you're following during camp, Jonathan?
Oh, there's so many. And I'm shocked you didn't bring up Ben Simmons and all that.
I was leaning there. I had to let Jeremy get a question. I was coming back to it.
Well, Ben Simmons, I'll do real quick, is that, you know, with the Rockets, Ben Simmons is a weird fit for a lot of teams, and the Rockets are definitely one of them. I think he could be in something of a Draymond Green, even Giannis-ish role, where he handles the ball and you make sure there's four shooters around him. Would he be okay with that? That's a big question. The Rockets or any other team would know from Rich Paul. Would you invest 4 years? His contract has 4 years left. I think if you're the Rockets, hey, their rebuilding's off to a nice start. They have some good pieces to work with. But come on, they are what they are. They need to keep taking big swings and chances. And that would be one. So if they could do it as part of moving John Wall, and you can also trade him. He's not like unmovable if it doesn't work out here after a year or two. So if you could do it without adding first-round pick assets, you know, I would think they'd have to do it. Daryl Morey is nowhere close to doing anything like that. But as time goes on, you know, it's something to watch. The money doesn't quite work. They'd have to add, like, Maxey or Thibault. In that case, the Rockets would have to add a pick, I would think, a good pick. Or they can go get the good pick elsewhere and can move Maxey or Thibault. Or the Sixers could add two of their first-round picks this year. It's something to watch. More likely, the Rockets become the third team in because they have a nice variety of contracts. For that matter, if the Sixers need an actual professional point guard just to run the point, T.J. Augustine would be a terrific fit there. A true pro, doesn't have to start, doesn't even have to play every single game, but he can come in and get everything all organized, which is what his role is here. If things are going haywire with the young guys, go in, just settle everybody down, and then we pass it back over to Kevin Porter Jr. and Jalen Green. As far as the storylines, obviously Jalen Green and the rookies are the biggest. You know, DJ put it really well yesterday. They're under control. They're 19 years old. And usually guys like that, especially with the physical abilities that they have, are playing too fast. They just do everything. These guys are under control. Very unusual to see. Jalen Green absolutely knows who he is and knows what's expected, knows what he wants in his career. And he's very determined to get it. He's got so much going for him right now as a player, as a personality, as a face of the franchise. And it's interesting. You know, Kevin Porter Jr., like at the team meeting the other day, they had a meeting before media day. And Kevin Porter Jr., you know, somebody put it to me, it was like he's in church. He was just so focused and so dialed in to everything. Jalen Green, you describe as so happy. The guy, he comes into the media room and, you know, the kid in the candy store, you know, he was just, and it's a nice mix of personalities, but people are really going to like Green as they get to see him because he takes so much, everybody likes him. Athlete, a professional athlete who takes joy in what they do.
Absolutely.
And he's got that going for him.
Jonathan, how much
there are other stories you can name? You know, Eric Gordon is interesting. Who's the small forward? Overlooked Jay Sean Tate, you know, sort of the middle child of the Rockets. So there's a lot to watch here.
How much of a story, not only for the Rockets, but now league-wide, is going to be the vaccination? Because we saw this morning the league come out and say basically what I was throwing at Jeremy yesterday, which is if these guys are going to be adamant about not getting the vaccination and not playing their home games, then they shouldn't be paid. And now, lo and behold, here comes the league to say, hey, if you don't play, you don't get paid. It seems like that's going to be the storyline of every camp as this story continues to develop.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of not much of a story here because it's 100. Every single player is fully vaccinated.
That's what I was going to ask you. Okay.
Yeah, so, you know, it doesn't come up here. They're at 100%. So they don't have to worry that much about it. And, you know, it makes everything better, not just when the game comes. If, you know, everybody's playing after what we saw last year, that's pretty huge.
But the whole idea of being in Galveston and you get away and you go to dinners together and you do, to have a guy who can't sit next to his teammates, can't go to dinner with his teammates, that's a big deal. But, you know, the whole doesn't get paid thing, I looked at it the other way, to where the NBA can't put in a vaccine mandate without agreement with the union. The union wouldn't do it. The NBA could say, okay, you can't play unless you're fully vaccinated. No, you got to pay them. You know, the union insists you got to pay. You got a contract. So you go pay them. No, you cannot play. Well, now you're just really hurting your team, your career, everything else. If the NBA wanted to force players to do this, which I think is the point of a vaccine mandate, which the NBA did want, that, to me, would be the way to do it.
Jonathan Fagan, thanks so much for stopping by. Enjoy your time there in Galveston with the Rockets training camp.
We'll do it. Thanks for having me.
You got it. Jonathan Fagan covers the Rockets for the Chronicle. Some interesting stuff he had to say there. What are the biggest storylines for you, think, during training camp there in Galveston? Regular season starts in 3 weeks.
Look, I think there's a couple of sleepers. I think the one that people aren't talking enough about is Daniel Theis. I think Daniel Theis is the guy that could be a big factor for this team. He's not going to be the Kelly Olynyk of a year ago, but he's going to do the dirty work. He's going to set the screens. He's not afraid to just pound the boards, play good defense, give you a guy that can guard someone in the low post, which has been a problem for the Rockets for a couple of years. So I'd keep an eye on that. And then where does Eric Gordon find a home? I think Jonathan was spot on with that. I don't think he's going to be with this team. Ideally, I don't think he should be with this team before the season starts to give everybody the best chance to move on. But again, because he's going to take minutes from another young guy, no matter which one you pick or say it could be, from Jayshon Tate, to all the other guys that are 19 to 23 that deserve the playing time to see what they got, he needs to find a new home. So where he goes and what they can get for him is another storyline that I'm interested in. And like I said, and you know what? The other one that's a sleeper for me is Stephen Silas. It's all calmed down for him. He got dealt the worst hand possible for a first-time NBA head coach, and then it just continued to get worse and have a downward swirl. This year, he seems to be refreshed. Seems to be like, it took that big deep breath and said, okay, all that other crap is behind me now. Now I can just do what I do, which is coach, and I really love coaching young guys like I did with Luka Doncic. Those are the kind of things that I think that they should really keep an eye on as camp gets going.
I think it's good good season, too, for the fans to kind of get another feel for what Silas is, right, as a head coach, you know, going into his second season, see if he can improve as a head coach, see where he stacks up around the NBA, too, as a head coach. All right, coming up next, Dusty Baker has decided his playoff rotation. It's the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
This is Heisman Trophy winner and College Football Hall of Fame, Mike Rozier, and you're listening to ESPN 97.5.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.